And she feels better too. I can tell. And I'm very happy about the about things cooling off. I would have gone out of town, or I would have gone to like a a river or drinking court, a swimming hole. But it was Memorial Day, and so I decided to spare myself of that whole mess. So hopefully, maybe this week and maybe next, maybe sometime in the future, I'll go somewhere in the Tillamook or Estacada, somewhere beautiful. But in the meanwhile, I'm stuck in this concrete jungle, having to walk. Yes, walk everywhere because it's too hot and I don't have AC. Althea, for our last minute, oh my goodness, the show is just over almost. For the last minute, how has your heat been? And yes, and that's it.
It's been a little much for me. I love Pacific Northwest summertime. I'm a big fan. I'm just not prepared for it in early June. That's more of a July kind of thing that I'm into. In July, it's like I'm mentally, I can wake up in the morning and be a little sweaty and I'll be okay with it. June, I'm not really into that. But glad we could debrief that. I wanted to make sure I wasn't the only one taken aback by these by the big summer weather. And anyway, I'm Althea. This is The Gap. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. Sonia, keeping us on the air. Thank you so much. Tammy, of course, my better half. Thank you all so much for listening. And coming up next is Wings.
Estás escuchando KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Today on Wings.
I'm Sophia Vavaroutsos.
And I'm Frida Worden.
Today, we are talking about the Haitian film Madame Sara and the heroic role of the Madame Sara. They are the market women who can be seen to hold the fabric of the Haitian economy and culture together through tumultuous times.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Gon côté, mesdames yo habité, bo pied bois, qui fait même son avec musique.
There's a place where women live near trees that blowing in the wind sound like music, where women return to their children as butterflies. My mother was as brave as the stars at dawn. From the thick of the cane fields, I tried to tell her, but the words would not roll off my tongue. There's a place where women are buried in clothes the color of flames. These are clips from the trailer for the film Madame Sara, directed by Etienne Dupin, which depicts the lives of the strong women in Haiti. As one sees in the film, the streets of Haiti are lined with small shops and vendor stands, selling everything from food to cosmetics to clothing. These women are the Madame Sara.
The film's publicist reached out to Wings because of our interest in international women's issues, but the primary audience for this Creole language documentary is Haitian people themselves, so the people will recognize the treasure they have in Haiti's tradeswomen and protect them from violence and exploitation.
According to the director of the film, Etan Dupin, the conditions the Madan Sara face need to be radically changed. One of the most important changes involves the way other people see the Madan Sara, especially Haitian men.
Especially Haitian men, we have a responsibility to speak loud and clear, and also if we're in a position of power to take action, because we cannot oppress half of the population, hundreds of thousands, businesswomen in the country, and talk about development.
Madan Sara connect rural to urban Haiti, providing necessary services and bringing materials from place to place, allowing for purchasing. Experts say they are the lifeline of the Haitian economy. One of these women is Clotilde Akil from Keshof. The main product she sells is vegetables, often working more than 12-hour days to facilitate her business. While Clotilde's work and that of other women like her is vital to the country still reeling from a deadly, tragic earthquake 11 years ago, the women have the odds stacked against them. From societal and economic challenges to the new challenges brought about by the COVID-19 pandemic, the women fight every day to provide for themselves, their families, their communities, and their country.
Legend has it that Madan Sara is a little bird that is really quick and that travels back and forth long distances.
Nora Jean Joseph sat down with me virtually, of course, from Haiti to elaborate on the work the Madan Sara do.
These are women who typically go and purchase crops, vegetables, anything that feeds the population. And they travel far distances to the urban areas and they sell them there. And sometimes they'll be like the first wave, then you'll have the second wave of Madan Sara. Buy from them and then go to even further markets. So it's a very elaborate market structure, and this is what pretty much feeds the population at large. Then there's also like other women that are also considered Madan Sara, who are not necessarily distributing food, but women who sell other things like clothing and shoes and what have you. And so really Madan Sara has become an all-encompassing term to reference most of the women in the informal sector.
Gon kote, mesdames yo habite bo pied bois ki fait même son avec musique.
That poem is from Edwige Dantika's novel Breath, Eyes, Memory. Dantika is a product of hard-working Haitian women.
Oh, absolument. Parce que premièrement,
I was raised by a community of Haitian women because my mother left when I was 4 years old and left me with my aunt. I had many women from the community who took my mother's place to raise me until I was 12 years old. My mother worked in a factory and my dad drove a taxi in New York. They left me with this really hard-working Haitian woman who raised and taught me. Not rich woman. They had to really hustle. Sometime when I was young, no one at home could take me to school. My aunt would send me with the water seller lady, who will go the same route and take me to school. That is one example of how I was raised by a community. My aunt had a business selling underwear on the main street. But when I left the main street, I would go to the market for dinner groceries and practice negotiation with the sellers, the Madan Saras. Sometimes, if they knew you and your connection, you could purchase and come back to pay later.
That was world-famous Haitian-American writer Edwige Dantika, speaking in Haitian Creole at the online debut of the film Madansara in March of 2021. Daruna Nikki, a 20-year-old Haitian Canadian, translated Dantika's remarks for Wings.
When I was translating it, I was like, oh, sounds like me. It's like, and it's not just her, like, many Haitian has that similar story.
While her mother was working in the Dominican Republic, Daruna lived with her grandmother.
It was the community full of Madansaras. I was practically raised by most of them. My grandmother was a Madansara. She, for a living, she used to just wake up like first thing in the morning to sell eggs, like as a Madansara, like around the street. Like she used to sell clothes, eggs, and like all just like produce stuff. And she had a business of charcoal. I'm not sure if you know charcoal, which is really common in Haiti. And that's how she raised her children.
Did she make any of those things?
If she made them?
Yeah, like did she make the charcoal or?
No. She did not make them. She would just get them as like big orders.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So were all the Madansaras in the area ordering together?
Yes. They would go together to get it because sometimes there's a trip to do to go get it, like it's out of town, all those grocery stuff, so they would constantly go with each other, or if one would go, then if they needed something for their own, they would let them or the Madansara know, so like together they would just get it, everything together.
In order to carry their merchandise, they will hire a driver who has a truck.
Nora Jean Joseph, who works with the Madansara through her company, Radical. I interviewed Nora, who is in Haiti right now, over WhatsApp, and there is some background noise, but I think it's really important that we hear what Nora has to say about this community, as her grandmother was a Madansara.
You know, the truck will be filled with all kinds of large bags of merchandise, whatever it might be. Women sell charcoal, they sell crops, they sell dried goods, I mean, whatever it might be. So the truck itself is full, and then these women are literally sitting on top of the truck, and they're traveling mountainous roads with very little, like, barriers on the side, 2.5 hours to Port-au-Prince on top of a truck. And the danger is that many, many times you've heard of an accident that happens on the road. It typically has had to do with an overfilled truck with women on top of it, and the truck would have fallen over on the side of the road, and basically everyone would have died.
Nora Jean Joseph is the founder of a Haitian company called Radical that recruits Madansaras for micro-franchises to make and sell organic cosmetics and foods. Radical also does business training and helps its recruits to obtain loans.
A lot of these women have a restriction in terms of credit. Even they likely don't have a banking account, which may or may not have its good points, but, you know, in our day and age, having at least one bank account helps with a certain amount of ability to access funds, for example, if you go to a bank. Secondly, even microfinance institutions, a lot of times, because of the high cost of providing credit, also typically end up having a high interest rate. So even if the woman is able to get a certain amount of credit to either start or grow their business, the level of credit is sometimes so high that it may or may not make sense for them. And thirdly, a lot of times, some women aren't even able to get credit at all, and they end up doing, I guess you could call it informal credit, if you will, which is basically when they borrow from there's not a term for it in English that I can think of, but if you can think of like Quicken Loans or something like that, where you can borrow $500, but then you end up paying them back like $1,000, it's like, okay, sure, get quick cash, but then by the time you end up paying it back, you're paying back so much more, like double what it is that you were borrowing. So one of our initiatives at Radical is actually to collaborate with microfinance institutions here some of which were featured in Itam's film as well, basically be like a guarantor for these women. And so what that means then is those MFIs can then look at the women and say, oh, okay, you're part of the radical network. So just as an example, instead of a 25% interest rate, we're going to let you borrow this money at a 5% interest rate, because we know that radical then serves as a guarantor for you and your business, and we feel more comfortable backing you up that way. And so that really helped us, and that really helped the women get into the dynamic of borrowing money, repaying money, also building their credit in a sense. It goes to show you the gap when they don't have somebody who can back them up versus when they do. And so obviously that has also taken a lot of negotiation from our end to the microfinance institution, but I think I think even for them it works also, because it's better to lend someone money knowing you're going to get your money back, right, as a guarantee, even if the interest rate is not as high.
While Madan Saras can use the help of the company Radical when they want to access formal bank loans, these Haitian businesswomen do have their own business methods and traditional financial support systems, as Daruna Nikki told Wings.
Did your grandmother do bookkeeping or anything for her business or anything like that?
Bookkeeping?
You know, like, how did she keep her accounts, her business accounts?
Oh, in a book, yeah. Yes, but by hand.
Yes.
Yeah, and by names, like, she had, like, a rule by names, when they were going to pay and the amount kind of thing, and then another page had like all the inventory things.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so she was a real businesswoman.
Oh, yes, she was, yeah.
The deferred payment scheme can work because the Madansaras have a close-knit community.
At least I can talk about my community. The houses are really like together. So they have to like constantly see each other. Mm-hmm. And then they just share with each other, and most of them goes like in the same church, so they know each other from there. And then there's like activities around the community, which is also full of Madansaras. They were well respected because it was a lot of women just like making a living. Most of them were single moms as well, who their man has left or never came back or like things like that, so they had to make a living. And most of them also had like big families, so they had to feed their children, which was the biggest motivation to go out. Like, everywhere you would go, like you would go to the big market and the Madansaras would be there, and you would be like, let's say you're gonna grab the taxi or the bus, like there was a Madansara with some peanuts or water or like all this kind of stuff, like up and down, they everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So did your grandma carry her supplies with her when she went to sell?
Yeah, most of the time, yes. She had a basket on her head.
On Wings, the topic is the Madansaras, the market women of Haiti.
So Madansaras buy from other Madansaras and support each other by easing off on the payments. Like if you didn't have enough payment for this month, we had this little chart of card that once you become like a frequent buyer, you get that little card, and then you buy like for 3 months in a row where you don't pay, and then you pay after in a row. And we had this also thing called SOL, which is like a loan thing. And how it works is there's a group of people, it can be up to 6 or 8 women or anyone who wants to be in it. You each every month give an expected amount of money, let's say 150 for a month, and then each of those people in the group get paid per year. You know what that, how does?
So, no, I don't quite understand. Okay, so they're all putting in money.
Yeah, they're all putting in money, and then they all collaborate that money and pay the first person. And then they go and do it again, and then they go to the next person until the whole group get paid.
Oh.
But it's money that they've been saving all together.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really common thing there.
I've heard of that happening in many countries in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of collective saving.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do they invest any of the money, or they just collect it and then they disperse it?
Yeah. They collect it all, and in that it's a big thing. Like, a lot of people in the community would get together and do it. And then that one person would get that money every month, and then you would know which turn is you, and then you would get paid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm thinking about why that's more useful than saving yourself. I guess because you need
you
a certain...
You would spend it, yeah.
You would spend it.
I would spend it.
Yeah.
Or you just... I don't know. It's like... Would you say it's like a bank? Yeah, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But not really, because there's not a lot of banks in Haiti. It's a chaos. There is a lot of, like, violent stuff because, of course, of the politicians. Like, they haven't been able to get the country right.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever a government in Haiti that was doing a good job?
Not that I remember, no. It's always been a chaos, as much as I remember.
The chaos Daruna Nikki refers to in Haiti is a product of both internal struggles and massive international meddling, with natural disasters also thrown into the mix. The film Madansara documents that the current government has built expensive indoor markets and tried marshaling the Madansaras to move into them. In this clip from the film, one of the new market halls is burning to the ground, a not uncommon event. A woman who borrowed large amounts of money to furbish and stock her stall realizes she has lost everything.
The clip you just heard is from the film Madansara and depicts a Madansara crying outside of a torched market. The political unrest in Haiti leads to retaliation between those on different sides of the political spectrum. Helping us to understand is Nora Jean Joseph, who works with the Madansara through her company Radical. While Nora explains that this isn't specifically against the Madansara, this is how people from differing political groups get each other's attention.
A day or two ago, due to what I qualify as political motivation, there were two large markets that were burned, one in the north and one in the west in Leoyang. And I was just looking at this video of the fire. And so a lot of times, the Madansara then have to suffer the consequences of attacks on their businesses, even if it's not like somebody's like, oh, let's go mess with the Madansara. And so we are looking for ways where insurance to be a factor, because this is one of the risks that they run. It's almost like natural disasters.
This, on top of risks of being robbed or scammed en route to selling, which can involve women walking several hours with large amounts of money and product.
There are just so many more risks. Obviously, aggression from men, like the farmers that they're buying from directly when they're negotiating, not wanting to give the right price.
And new this year, Nora points out an entirely different challenge the Madansara are facing. It is one we are all familiar with, but provides an additional obstacle to already unprotected workers, the COVID-19 pandemic.
Having some of the lockdowns and restrictions has definitely been hard on the Madansara, because this is how they make their bread and butter, and it's usually on a daily basis. Certain markets had restricted activities to like 1 or 2 days a week. Certain markets shut down completely, which kind of translates to losing certain crops, because storage is difficult, right? A lot of these stocking places don't have proper storage. So if you, let's say you have lettuce, then if you're not selling for several days at a time, you're definitely going to lose a lot more of your inventory. One of the things that we've been looking into from some of our Manasai, many of them who have already started this type of practice, has been to deliver packages. So like some of them actually, and this is from when I was younger, really, but like now it's probably a little bit more sophisticated in terms of like hiring a motorcycle and delivering a package to a client's house, or having the client come pick it up directly from them. So this is something we've been looking in at, like, how can we help the Madansara by having their clients order directly from them, either for pickup or delivery, that when you have a situation, you know, that restricts the commerce the way that COVID has, finding ways around that.
Experts agree that the conditions Madansara face need to change, not only because their work so greatly impacts Haiti's economy, but because the work they do impacts Haiti's future. We're going back to Clotilde Akil, who's featured in the film Madansara. She says that her business has allowed her to provide for her 5 children. Madansara are able to pay for their children to go to school and post-secondary education, which can help lift up future generations.
We impress upon students to be in this space, which is dignified, of an institution of higher learning. Our teachers deal with the students in a dignified way, and we want them to assume this dignity, to express it among themselves, with the staff, with their professors.
This is Mildred Trio-Aristide, former First Lady and co-founder of the Aristide Foundation University in Haiti. She was interviewed by Margaret Prescott of Sojourner Truth Radio on the occasion of the school's first medical student graduation in 2019.
If you go to the auditorium there, there's a huge sign with a sentence on it. That is our motto. And in Creole, it says, Sin pas sauve dintin, dintin ab sauve kitim. And if I can translate, if you do not safeguard your dignity will leave you.
I don't know if you're Aristide, if you're Jovenel. Outside of the politics, I think it's a shame for us to create a situation of terror where people cannot do their businesses, where people cannot, you know, go out and live their lives.
Madansara film director, Etan Dupin.
Like one person said in the film, they use burning market as political weapon against these businesswomen, against the Madansara, which is a shame across the board for all of us as a society.
The Madansara are an example of women who have served their families, communities, and country. Like many women throughout history, they face extraordinary challenges and little recognition in doing so. But with films like Madansara and companies like Radical, that narrative is beginning to change and could lead to safer work in the future. The life of a Madansara is a complicated one. Alongside so much pride for the work they do and the crucial ways they contribute to Haiti's economy, there is still so much left to do to change the circumstances they are often left to face alone.
Gon kote, mesdames yo habite, bo pie bois, ki fè même son avec musique.
Today you heard clips from Etan Dupin's film Madansara and clips from his virtual screening with Street Team Productions. You heard from Nora Jean Joseph, founder and CEO of Radical, providing context and insight into the world of the Madansara. And I'm Sophia Vavaroutsos, reporting for Wings.
And I'm Frida Worden, also reporting for Wings. I want to thank Margaret Prescott and Sojourner Truth Radio for the clip of Mildred Trio-Aristide, and also thank my neighbor Daruna Nikki, both for translation and for generously sitting to be interviewed about her grandmother and the other Madansara. She is a young woman of great dignity and a testament to the grandmother who raised her. I'll give her the last word.
So tell me what your grandma looked like.
Oh, she's beautiful. Yeah, she looks like me, I guess. Yeah, she is wonderful, and she's really strong. Well, because she walks a lot, right? That's why she did for a living for a long time. She's 74, I think, now, and she's still strong, like she's ready to work.
What's your favorite thing about your grandma?
She's really kind. Yeah, she's really, really, really kind.
Did she teach you things?
Yes.
What did she teach you?
She teach me how to
sew?
She teach me how to sew. She teach me how to cook. She teach me how to do everything because she raised me. I was raised by my grandma, not by my mom. So everything I know, pretty much, was taught by my grandma.
To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. You can also visit our website, wingsradio.org/wordpress. And check out our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks your local community radio stations and all our other supporters, including the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, Carolyn Byerly, Sheila Dellis-Katzman, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose fortnightly series of salons can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's maternalgifteconomymovement, all one word, .org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Good morning. This is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder.
Board operator.
Welcome. So in the studio today with me is Nico and Alan. Welcome back. It's nice to see you again, and if you don't mind, we'll get started with some questions here. So who are you guys?
Can I go first?
This is Alan Hines. He's the director of the Real Choice Initiative, and I'm going to do communication support for Alan. I use he, him pronouns. And I'm happy to be here. Yeah. My name is Nico Sara. I use they pronouns. I am a mostly white passing person of color with disabilities. I'm queer and transgender, and I'm a disability justice organizer, and I'm really excited to do this interview with you, a good friend of ours, John. Thank you so much for asking us to be here with you today.
First question, what is the name of the study?
So the study is called the Disability Equity and Engagement Study. And we are gathering some information about the disability community. And we're really focused on learning about the social determinants of health. And how that impacts people's engagement with the city.
Who is sponsoring it and why?
Sure, yeah. So I think the city of Portland, really, this was several years ago, they started realizing that there were not a lot of people with disabilities and people with more serious health conditions, that we were, as a population, not as engaged with the city. And so they started wondering why that was. And that was part of what kind of preceded this whole initiative. And so the city of Portland is actually, they're the people who are funding this this study. And we, as Real Choice Initiative, were selected to be the community organization that's going to lead the study. And we are also asked to collaborate with the Portland State School of Government professor up there, who is going to be our number cruncher and do all of the sort of scientific research number crunching of when we actually get the numbers and make all of those things work.
So, Alan and Nico, how is the survey going?
It's going really well, John. We're thrilled to get a huge response. In just the first week, we've had over 500 people take the survey. That's super exciting because we thought that we were maybe going to get 350 responses in 6 weeks. We got 500 responses in one. So that is so exciting. More specifically, we've gotten about 50 responses from Chinese-speaking folks, almost 20 responses from Spanish-speaking folks, just a few in the Russian community, and only a few in the Vietnamese community. So we're hoping to do more focused outreach there. And we also have it available by a screen reader. But in general, we are totally thrilled about the response and hope people will continue taking the survey. It is available until July 2nd at realchoiceoregon.com.
And is there a phone number?
Yeah, and people can take the survey by calling 503-877-5418, and we have the survey available in English and Spanish.
So we have a little clip for y'all to listen to. Here we go.
All right, and this is with Layla Hale and Lids, who are also helping to put together this survey and are going to be some of the survey takers and our social media influencers and just all around amazing individuals. So here's the clip. Thanks, John.
My name is Layla Hale. I use they, them pronouns, and I work for the Office of Equity and Human Rights as their ADA Title II coordinator. And I am really excited about this project because I know that data is, you know, the first step in getting done what we need to get done. If the data doesn't exist, then the problem doesn't exist. So I'm really excited to be, to assist in being a megaphone to those with power, to amplify the needs that we know have been in our community for a very long time.
Hi, my name is Liz, and I also use they, them pronouns. I'm really excited to be a part of this project. I'm an artist and organizer, and my entire goal is to basically help organize all of the stuff that's already happening and make sure that, you know, Indigenous folks and queer folks and disabled folks and anyone who experiences marginalized identities has voices and doesn't have to rely on people talking for us. So yeah, that's kind of what I do, and I'm helping with communication.
Well, we're gonna check in with y'all first and make sure that we got it right, because that's important to us, and we really do care about what you think about what's being presented and what's being collected and what's gonna be happening as we go on. And I'm so grateful, Layla, that we're gonna be passing the baton to you in this marathon. And I don't know, I don't wanna call it a marathon. Like, I kinda wanna think of it as like a luxurious stroll through like the most beautiful forest park or something, like, because it just, I can't run the marathon anymore. Like, we've been working on this project in particular for a really, really long time, and sometimes, like, I'll just speak frankly, like, dealing with bureaucracy and for people who've got disabilities, like, y'all are gonna maybe identify with this, that it can be exhausting to do that. And so, you know, working on this study for a really long time, like, some of it has been like, it's been kind of hard. So I'm glad that, like, we get to kind of pass the baton back and forth to each other. And that's part of learning how to live with our bodies moving around differently in the world. And like, our abilities changing and stuff is learning how to pace ourselves and learning how to rely on one another and being able to pass things back and forth and say like, okay, I got to take a break now. Here you go. Yeah.
And I really feel like that's the lesson that governmental power needs to learn, is that it is a marathon. Like, absolutely. And the reason, part of the reason that disabled folks or folks with disabilities are so perfect and primed for this work is that we understand what it is to survive under very, very grueling governmental bureaucratic, like the image that comes to mind is like a mortar and pestle, like just being ground up by the system over and over. So we understand that like that passing of the baton is part of a collective survival. Like it's part of how we know how to get the work done, is that like no one should be expected to grind all the time, every single second, because that's what capitalism wants us to do. And that's what white supremacy wants us to do, is think that there's this like this urgency that like all the time you have to be given 110%. And like, I'm just picturing like, you know, Gatorade neon colors flashing behind me and like, ga, ga, all the time. And it's like, no, like collective struggle is how we move forward. And it's the only way forward. And it's the only way that change has ever happened is collective struggle. Like laws are cute. Policy is cute, but those are always dripped in blood, because how many people had to die before this became policy? And like part of the study for me is pushing that like incremental governmental like change is no longer accessible or no longer acceptable. Like it never was, but like not on our watch, you know, like, and this is part of us changing, like grinding against the gears, right? We're just all a handful of sand in this machine and deciding how we're going to grind up against the gears and stop it so that we can actually like live and make change happen. Y'all got me in a caffeine fueled rant. Sorry.
I love it. I think that's really important, Alan says. So yeah, I think that's really important. So RCI, Real Choice Initiative, is an organization that helps people transition out of group settings. And we're also an advocacy organization. We also know where our community needs to push. To be able to make some of the changes that we really need. So that our community members can live out in the general community. Like, we don't all need to live in group settings. But the way that the system is set up makes it really difficult. Makes it really difficult for people to live independently and in the community. So we collectively need to make fundamental changes to the city. And this data is a move in that direction. And we can present this data to the city. And the city can work with it however they need to work with it. And we expect to see some progress.
And then we know that we will need to come back.
But in the end, we know that we will need to come back. And really push for the changes that need to happen.
So this is a cyclical.
So this is a cyclical
thing.
So this is going to be the first movement in a long series of movements. Well, and I just want to take a second to say that Alan knows what he's talking about with strategy, because he's one of the people that
that is responsible for all of the new corners that are going in all over the city, because the city did not have accessible corners for people with wheelchairs and people who are also using like baby strollers and stuff too, and skateboards and bicycles and stuff. And Alan and a couple of our other friends had to sue the city to get those things done. And now the city has to replace a certain number of curb corners over the next 12 years. So, you know, like literally seeing these things physically happening, this is one, you know, he's one of the reasons why these things are happening. But lawsuits, Alan says, lawsuits are only one tool in the box. We've got other tools in the box, right, too. So we went to Home Forward and said, there are all these people living in institutions that don't need to be in institutions, and they really want to live independently. They just can't afford it. And the federal government has vouchers that can make living independently more accessible. We need to go together to them to get them released to Multnomah County. Will you come with us? And Home Forward said yes. And we were able to get 99 vouchers, they're called mainstream vouchers, in Multnomah County that year. That was a couple of years ago. I think that was 2018. Mm-hmm. And there were over 700 people who applied for those vouchers that can only go to people who are living in group homes, adult foster cares, nursing homes, other facilities like that, mental health homes, places like that. Then a bunch of other counties, there were 9 other counties the next year that went out and applied for more of those vouchers throughout the state. And as far as we know, there's been hundreds more vouchers that have been going throughout the state of Oregon since we started that process in the state of Oregon. So like, this is something that's really cool, because again, that's another tool in the box. You know, we got to put the pressure in the right spot at the right time. Figuring out how to call each other in instead of calling each other out, and who we can work with, and who is somebody that we're just like, okay, maybe this isn't going to work right now. And it's a complicated process. I'm super excited to be taking a class right now with Loretta Ross, who's teaching me about gently calling people in that I can work with. And that's something that I want to learn how to do better. Because there are a lot of allies out there that I get frustrated with, because we're not on the same page. But it's like, look, we're in a movement together. We don't have to be on the same page about everything. We're moving in the same direction, right? When we're thinking exactly the same thing, that's not a movement, that's a cult, right? But we're moving in the same direction. We all want the same thing, and we're moving in the same direction. That's what we're doing together. We don't have to be in agreement about every single thing.
Like what collective liberation truly is, because sometimes our needs are not in alignment, right? Like sometimes they're in direct conflict with each other, but we learn how to make it work, right? And because we learned, like, okay, if these folks can't be in a room because someone needs, like, sorry, I'm pulling random examples, but if someone needs like really, really high specific natural light, and other people like are prone to migraines that can't handle like high light and just need to be wearing sunglasses all the time, like we know how to move things to make things work. And I feel like it's not so much that, you know, it's not like we're unable to do things, right? It's not like we're unable to move mountains. We just need y'all to get out of our way and let us do what we know is best for us. And I feel like that's the lesson that like able-bodied folks and like neurotypical folks are not able to pick up. And it's super frustrating to like, you know, watch someone just kind of like bonk into the same problem over and over and over again, when you're like, okay, we can, you know, we feel like we were doing all these things, we're waving flags, we're sounding air horns, we're making vibrations, you know, we're using every like mode of communication that we know how to use as people, only to like have it be ignored pretty much. So I feel like, yes, that strategy piece takes away the choice to ignore us in all the many ways we are communicating our needs.
I'm in a different direction, because I'm sitting here like, see, this is all cool. This is like the long-term strategy, but I also think it's important to say, you know, so the first 100 people who take this survey actually get a gift card. So that's like an immediate need. So it's like, that's something that's like right here, right now. Because I always think about like, how am I going to tell people that I care about why this is important right now? And I'm like, well, get your gift card. Get that, And then secondly, it's like one of the biggest things that's been coming up in, it comes up in organizing over and over and over, is the intentional displacement of communities and the intentional interruption of community knowledge. Portland's trying to counteract it by having a survey, and I will take that inch and run a mile. I'm really thankful, because even as we're talking about like the long-term plans of like, how's this gonna help in the future? I mean, if I can be honest, when I hear that, yes, over the next 12 years, they have to do something about the accessibility of sidewalks, I think, well, 12 years is a long time. But then on the other end of it, because the survey has been designed by us, who are also disabled, who are also members of the community, who are also like multiply marginalized folks, it's not just about in 12 years. Also, you get, you know, the first 100 people get a gift card. And then on top of that, like one of the things that is really difficult about being disabled is that we're in a disabling society. So it's hard for us to connect to each other, but this is a way that we can. Like, we're not just taking a survey that's going to be sitting on someone's desk. Like, by taking the survey, you're able to access this community building that we're doing together. Like, this isn't just some guy in a suit trying to get elected. Well, I mean, if it was, we stole it from whoever that person was, and now it's ours. Now it's for the community, by the community, and we can actually do something with it. So, you know, in addition to all of these long-term things, there's stuff that's going to happen in the next few months, starting with a gift card. Like, I mean, let's get food on the table. Let's get to know each other. Let's, like, you know, in the same way that we've survived oppression, we've gained tools of resilience. And so that's, you know, that's what's happening now. So that's my caffeine rant.
Nice. No, I really love that, because it gets to the point of like, we're thinking holistically, right? We're thinking about the now, the 2 days from now, the 3 weeks from now, the 6 months from now, the 12 years from now, right? We're thinking about that every step along the way. Because like, I also view the town hall as being an opportunity to really solidify what a mutual aid network for folks with disabilities looks like. Like, that's what I see my job at the city as being, is like, what can I do? What can I institutionalize for us that says like, we have this, it's not going away. So that like, whoever the next me is, like, what is left after that? So I wanna know, like, you know, how are we going to survive the next pandemic? Because the same conditions that led to this one are still in place. So it's coming down the road. What are we doing during the next fire? What are we doing? And like, I've been having conversations with the Joint Volunteer Committee for the emergency management team for Portland, or like the emergency management center. And those folks are they're hearing a lot of what we've been saying already. And what the community has been saying, especially in response to the pandemic and lack of response to the pandemic, if I can be more accurate. And they don't want to lose those lessons. So there's a lot of momentum behind get everything out of the way and do what we need to do. So I definitely want to see, like, is the city going to, you know, support specific nonprofits in their work? Is the city going to support certain grassroots organizations? Because we don't always have access to a 501c3 in doing the work that we know we need to do, right? We don't always have access to permits. We don't always have access to bank accounts, because people don't let us have bank accounts, right? People don't let us get married. Like, there's all these things we don't have access to, all of these structures that are traditionally used for movement building that just aren't working. So I'm hearing a lot of like, the law is the floor, not the ceiling. Like, they didn't tell us what we can't do yet, right? So tell us what we can do. That's, you know, not necessarily violating federal law, but like, what needs to be, right? Do we need a depot that has, you know, assistive devices where people can drop off, pick up as needed? Do we need to have like more like food pantries? Do we need a hotel? Like, right? What is it that we need? Because, you know, we have folks in power with enough personal wealth to solve the problems that we're asking to be solved, right? And so make it make sense. So I want this to be an opportunity for folks to speak directly to people in power and to not hold back. Like, yes, there are certain things that I can't say because of my position at the city, because I'll get in trouble or get fired or whatever, whatever. I recognize that, and I say that out loud. So I use that as a conduit to say, like, you know, let me hold up the speech bubble so I'm not saying it, but somebody is, right? Because there's power in that. There's real power in that. And part of, I feel like a part of accountability on the part of the government is not gaslighting people and saying that, yes, this is happening. We acknowledge it. This is a messed up system. It is patriarchal. It is white supremacist. It is all of these systems that we know are harmful. Yes, that conversation is over. Let's move forward.
Mic drop.
Oh, Liz said, mic drop. People with disabilities and people with serious health issues and stuff, we are the most creative, innovative, like we come up with the solutions that nobody else would think of. I mean, because we've had to. I mean, like, for example, like I have this neurological condition where I have not really been able to look at screens. And you can imagine that during COVID, all of this, everything is all on screens. Like all of the work that I'm trying to do is looking at screens on my phone, on the computer, everything. Doing it right now, right? Trying to relax. Everything is all about looking at a screen. And so I couldn't do that without having really severe issues that were causing to be on really intense medications that were causing a lot of other problems. And so it became a really serious issue around Thanksgiving. I am so blessed that I have blind friends that I called up and I was just like, hey, I've got an iPhone. Can you teach me like the basics of how to use a screen reader? And I was able to learn how to use a screen reader, like at least a little bit, so that I could get through some of the stuff that I had to do and finish some of my homework for some of the positions that I hold. And I found other creative ways to do things. And so many people with this, I mean, just everybody that's in this conversation could probably tell like 10 different stories about creative ways that we have figured out. And everybody that's watching this, I'm sure has all of their own different stories about how they've figured out how to get around nutritional things or housing things or medical needs or getting to, you know, transportation things. You name it, we have come up with the most ingenious, brilliant things to get around some of these problems. And so I'm just constantly astonished by just how amazing our community is and it's amazing to me.
This is John Griffiths. This has been Disability Justice and Everyday Pursuit and Survival. Thanks for joining us today and come back soon.
KBOO is member-supported by listeners like you. If you're interested in becoming a member or supporting KBOO in some way, you can go to kboo.fm and go to their link of how to support KBOO.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kboo.org.
Also, we're always looking for fun, inexpensive things to do out in the community. Go to disabilityjustice@kboo.org to contact us and give us your ideas.
supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Film at 11 here on community radio, KBOO Portland. Today, we have two or